Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. We come to you from the Egg Center for the Performing Arts in Albany, New York, before a live audience in the Swire Theater. Dancer, choreographer, and director Bill T. Jones reflects on his art and life in his new book, Story Time. The book is filled with telling vignettes about Jones's childhood as part of a large, poor Southern family that migrated to upstate New York, about his struggles to find a place for himself in the white-dominated dance world, and about the encounters with notable artists and musicians. And Jones wrestles with questions of how an artist can remain true to himself while still caring about the popular reception of his work. The new book is Story Time, The Life of an Idea. He is the recipient of many awards and honors, including Tony Awards for Fela and Spring Awakening, a Kennedy Center honor, and a MacArthur Fellowship. Please join me in welcoming Bill T. Jones to this week's book show.
Thank you, my friend.
It is such a pleasure to be with you and to have you before this crowd and to be with us on the program. The book is beautiful. It is story/time. You've done that before with that emphasis of the slash in other work.
Yes,
why is that significant to you?
Well, it's how you can speak about opposition, you can speak about juxtaposition, and as I often say, for those persons who are poets in the audience or love poetry, Frank O'Hara, in his poem Memorial Day 1950, says, naming things is only the intention to make things. And so it's a very clinical way of, this is about stories, it's about time.
The story part is fairly obvious, and you will demonstrate that in a few moments for us, I hope. Talk to us about time and the idea in this work, because this book came out of a performance of the same name, in which time was very much an aspect.
Yes. Hearing your introduction, it was interesting that from the point of view of a book show, I'm being related to as if I am an author. The way in which you typify the book, it's true, but in a way, the most important thing is John Cage. John Cage, for those of you who know, was a lightning rod for criticism about modernism. He was a great instructor to a lot of artists. Merce Cunningham, many, many people learned from John Cage in this idea of indeterminacy. He made a historic work, and it was just him on stage reading 90 stories in 90 minutes. Each story, if it was 200 words, was read in a minute, or if it was only 30 words read in a minute, because he saw it as a musical problem. What I'm doing, actually, is setting up that very famous, and I should say infamous, exercise with a kind of a poker face, as if I'm just going to imitate him. Time has passed, and I'm a very different man from John Cage. So there's actually a discourse, a discussion going on with him. He said that he wanted to get rid of a romantic notion from German Romanticism, that every work of composition should start with theme, variation, climax, conclusion. He thought that was like a dead end. That's what we expect in all of our art forms. So he was looking for a way to get rid of that paradigm. So you asked me about time. I am an improviser, and you see I've gone on very long with the answer you've given me. But he insisted on holding himself to this strict, strict rule as a way of harnessing something which is true about the universe. It seems to be chaotic, but when an artist does a simple thing like put a time limit on something, we begin to see unity in chaos. That's what his feeling was. So that these 90 stories that he wrote just came like a torrent of his preoccupations. And the audience is there dealing with it. And there's something about the mind, we begin to find patterns, and we begin to find significance. So John Cage is the center of our preoccupation here. Bill T. Jones, another man, 40, 50 years later, comes along and takes his idea and says, okay, what if I put on this suit of clothing? What does it look like? What does it sound like? And this book is an artifact from that performance.
Earlier during sound check, I asked you if you would read some pieces, and you handed me the book, and you said, here, you choose them. and that threw me off.
But you were great.
Well, thank you. But that is the random nature of it.
Yes. You were the indeterminate source. So I ask you to take that. I could have gone off, but I wanted to know. I learned something about you. I learned about your professionalism. I saw you thinking of the rise and fall of it. I saw you thinking about content. And I said nothing about it. So we collaborated, actually.
Well, I'll put that on the resume. That's cool. I'm hoping you will read.
And one disclaimer is that these stories are in the book. They're written as if they were scored for music. Every second is accounted for. 60 seconds makes for 6 10-second lines. I'm going to just be reading them to compress the time, but try to imagine some of them are, well, they're very odd pauses because Ted Coffey, my composer, collaborator, is making it like music. Should we jump in? And I chose 5. I feel in performance that it takes at least 10 or 15 for you to get over your discomfort with why is that following this one, and you begin to move along with it. But for the sake of our conversation, I'm just going to read 5. You get a sense of what it's like. It was a Saturday morning, 1972. I had left Arnie relaxing in a patch of sunlight on the front stoop of our tenement, dressed in pink petal pushers and a polka dot present blouse. His thick, dark hair was free and luxurious. I returned a few hours later. His outfit, like his demeanor, had become darkly masculine. His hair was pulled severely back. What happened, I asked. It seems that a car full of young teenage men had started harassing him. Arnie had picked up a large, heavy metal drawer from a pile of junk and hurled it across the lane of highway, damaging their car. The driver screamed that he was going to get the police. Arnie dashed upstairs to adjust his appearance. Before long, the damaged car appeared, followed by a police vehicle. As the young driver opened his mouth, Arnie announced, "Officer, I would like to file charges against these young men." The young driver's eyes bulged. As he stammered, the policeman ordered him to shut up, get back in the car, and show his license. The cop turned to Arnie, saying, "I'm so sorry, sir. It's a shame with these young people. The parents are the problem." At Bard College, during a lull in rehearsal in Theater 2, I was leaving the stage as dancer LaMichael was returning to it, applying a Band-Aid to his finger. "Battle wound?" I asked, assuming he had done it just now in rehearsal. "No, I did it at breakfast." Walking away from him, I turned as he continued, "But it was an accident." I think it was a joke. Still, I had a momentary barrage of images. A self-inflicted death by a thousand cuts. A god who, out of uncontrollable anger, devours himself until there are only his eyes and ravenous mouth left. LaMichael, making breakfast of himself, one finger at a time. Another story my mother told. I'm not sure if she witnessed it or if she was recalling her mother Anna's memory. Here, too, there's a small child, 3 years old or so, much loved and curious to a fault. It seems that the family was living in a small shack, or was it a rundown tenement somewhere in the South, and the children were often left alone. The apartment was infested with rats, and rat poison was placed in holes in the walls. Was it its shape, its color, its smell? For whatever reason, this small child was fascinated with it. She was found, stiff as a board, standing dead on tiptoe, with her face on the wall, my mother said. It was the fall of 1972 in Binghamton. I moved in a fog of guilt and uncertainty, convinced that the only reliable life for me would be monastic. I was practicing yoga and chanting Hare Krishna daily. A guru had to be the solution. After all, When the student is ready, the teacher appears. Alone, down on my knees, performing my job at the university library, a voice said, "I have been looking for you." I looked up into the face of a handsome East Indian man beaming down at me. I was thunderstruck. Actually, he had been looking for a space to conduct his meditation classes, and someone must have told him I was a member of a dance collective with a loft in downtown Binghamton. I became one of his students, a vegetarian, and proposed celibacy to Arnie. One Saturday morning, at a street fair, I bumped into Mirsa, my teacher, eating a hot dog and strolling with his wife. I was shaken. Though nothing was said then or later, he did teach me a number of mind-focusing exercises. We saw less and less of one another, and then he moved away. When I last saw Estella in the hospital bed, she barely recognized me. And yet, when they placed one of her great-grandbabies on her chest, and the little one started rooting around, grunting with pleasure, pulling at her nightgown and cheeks, sucking on her chin, her eyes opened, and she smiled. Estella wanted nothing more than to stand up, but the best she could do was to sit in a specially constructed chair placed there by nurses and a lift team. Barely able to speak, she wanted to sing, and she sang the same song over and over again. Walk with me, Lord. Walk with me. Walk with me, Lord. Please walk with me. While I'm on this tedious journey, walk with me, Lord. Thank you.
Bill T. Jones is our guest on this week's book show. The book is Story Time, The Life of an Idea. It is published by Princeton University Press. Talk a little bit about language. We just heard language, and obviously another component of story time as a performance is the dance, which is in and of itself a language.
Yes, right on. You're absolutely correct. And it's one of those things which I'm dealing with now this late in my career, because I started out as a theater person who was introduced to dance and then to a kind of experimental dance. What should we call it? Postmodern dance. Postmodern dance said that dance was not beholden to any other art form. For many years, people said the dance was a sleeping beauty. Dance would be in an opera, you know, you'd have the diva singing, and then when you wanted to express her inner life, a skinny ballerina would come out, a svelte, thin, graceful ballerina would come out and dance her heart. And then they would trundle them off and the drama would continue. Dance said, no, we don't just illustrate other people's wants. And my generation came along and we were even more radical. We said, well, let's do a mashup, at least I was saying, a mashup between speaking and dancing, with the assumption that the results would be greater than the sum of its parts. Now, that's how I began with my early talking solos, doing abstraction, waving my arms, and then telling some story, not unlike some of these stories. My company, over the years, we've stayed true to that. Now, the language has become more, maybe more precise. This is actually a book now. It's done by the second and what have you. But there's still this idea that the audience is being required to watch a language on stage, and at the same time, make, if they will, another meaning by listening to this ticker tape of information that's going on at the same time. Now, is this unfair? We say that since we've been liberated by the visual arts, for instance, what would one have made of a cubist canvas? And you have all these shapes, geometric shapes, and then you see what looks like I think that's a woman's breast, and then I think that's a lip, and now there is a bit of language written on it. So I'm expected to have the visual experience of two-dimensional space. I'm also expected to recognize biomorphic forms. And then what's that word doing there? There's a lot that the artist was juggling and asking you to come closer and experience. Move forward to abstract expressionism. Jackson Pollock throws paint and it runs down the canvas. What is this? What's it mean? Where do I look? He was saying, look at the painting as free as you can, and it's a record of an event. When I was making my early dances, look at my body, young, athletic, black man on stage, usually in front of a room full of white people, because that's the way the modern dance world is or was if you were not doing Alvin Ailey. And now I'm going to be moving my body, and I know that my body is the same body that we all invest in sports, we invest in boxing. Depending on who we are, we might have fears about it, we might have sexual attraction to it. And I'm going to tell you a story about thinking while I'm dancing. And I'm going to say to you, well, I wonder what you're thinking about my body right now, as I'm in fact inviting you to look at my body. And I'm talking to you. So you're being pulled in two directions, one which is a pure sensual experience and the other which is an intellectual experience. And I said that that experience was greater than the sum of its parts.
When you talk about the universal nature of it, how do you and how have you used the language of your body as your body has aged and changed?
Well, I am retired right now.
Right.
My last performance was probably 10 years ago, and it was a solo performance at the Louvre in Paris, in which I attempted to dance 450 feet from Michelangelo's Bound Slave to the Winged Victory within a tiny little audience, because, you know, couldn't have that many people in there. The audience was maybe 60 people. That was the last time I danced. Right now, dancing is about trying to create a community of movers and makers. That's where I am right now, but I do say that I dance personally when I'm very happy. I do still love to move, but I don't want to subject myself to the same schedule that my young dancers must. But I do like when I'm very happy or I'm feeling love for a friend, I move. And an older man's body has to be very wise, because you have to do more with less. I was a big jumper. In my athletic training, I love to move quickly, and I love to change levels. So when I have this right knee hurts, I'm saying, remember when you were 21 years old and what you did to that knee? So that's my dancing. But if it's about ideas, the idea does not stop with my body.
On the heels of you just explaining that you'll dance when you're happy, I've heard you say that when asked of the question of what does it mean to be a real black person, that you say that's an angry person.
Have I said that?
You have said that.
Well, I think I was being somewhat ironic, but I think there's some truth in it. Real black person was something that for years I didn't deal with. Because I come from a black American family from the South, and my dad wanted to be a black Yankee, moved to the Finger Lakes region, not too far from us here. And we were there to harvest the fruits and vegetables. I went to school with the same German-Italian kids, K through 12. Some of them I'm still close to. My mature relationships, they have been, first of all, homosexual, and they're usually with, I've had three companions. Two of them are Jewish men, and one of them was a what we call a white Puerto Rican. So what I think I was trying to say was, in some ways, authenticity is determined by the culture that, for black artists, it's about a trauma narrative. It's about slavery, it's about Jim Crow, it's about all those things. So I was probably being a little dramatic just to make a point. I now feel black is one of the things that I am. It's a thing I love. Black allows me to sing the song that my mother taught me there. But no, I think that right now there's a whole generation of young folks coming along who are teaching us something about what is and is not relevant to their skin color. We don't want everyone to be the same, now do we? But then again, it shouldn't be a barrier to us. And a person should be allowed to define themselves in any way they want to. And this is the question right now about transgender people. We all have a learning curve about someone says, I do not feel like a male, therefore I will change and I will be a female. It's their right to identify themselves. And I think, now this is a dangerous thing to say, but I think the same is true with race.
You once said to a group of French journalists, I am the surviving member of a celebrated homosexual interracial duet couple.
This man has done his homework, right? Yeah. Well, I did, and it was at a time when they perked up and they scribbled that down, and that comment followed me around for a few years. Every review would start with that, you know. I needed to hear myself say it.
My question when I heard that was, are you trying to set the definition of who you are, or are you constantly trying to change the definition so you can't be defined?
Now, you realize that statement was made in the hot and sweaty grip of the culture wars. When Arnie died, this is around the time that people were being had their grants from the NEA taken away because they were promoting so-called aberrant lifestyles, they were anti-Christian, anti-family values, all those things. So there was a lot of stuff around who I am that was very much in the spirit of that. And in Europe, the narrative used to be we loved the suffering, oppressed cast-offs from America. So if you want to be a success in your jazz or what have you, you could go to Europe and they would embrace you. And I thought that was a little smug, and I thought that they were also a bit patronizing in that. And so I said, you know, quite frankly, you look at me and I am the surviving member of a celebrated interracial homosexual duet. Now deal with that one. You know, so how many minorities am I? And at the same time, I said, I am an artist and I am a world artist. I'm not some special case. But my identity, because the other thing I used to often say when people ask me, oh, you're so political, what does an artist have to do? Now, some of you have heard this, I'm sure, but I say an artist does not have to do a thing. An artist should be the freest person, sometimes running literally naked, thumbing their nose at all dogma. The question is, what does an artist who is a man, a woman, a transgender, a person with a social location and a race, what does that person need to do? That's completely up in the air. So there's no prescriptions about what the correct thing for a black artist to do, a gay artist to do. Those are all important, but what is that person who identifies with those categories, what do they need to do? That's what my answer was to the culture wars. And quite frankly, it's still the way I feel now.
Do you always know what you need to do?
No, I don't always know. I know that I'm in love right now. I know that the person that I am with, I want to be with for the rest of my life. I know that his 94-year-old mother is here today, and I always want her to be proud of me. I would like my work to have a certain rigor to it. It needs to have a rigor to it. I want to be proud of it. But just like it, you know, I'm in therapy, there's a lot of motivations that I don't understand. And I'm constantly tripping over myself. But I do need to understand myself better. And by understanding myself better, I understand other people better.
Do you think that changes how the audience understands you and understands the work?
I have no idea. You know, because one thing about the audience...
And do you care?
I do care.
Okay.
I do care. Unfortunately, I'm a showman, and I want to win, and I want to be loved. All that stuff, it makes me ridiculous. But sometimes you got to act as you would be. Who was that, Socrates? Right?
Sure.
Yeah. Act as you would be, and I am a bad bop, 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 and I am fearless, but I'm trembling inside, but I'm also very generous, and quite frankly, I really believe that we're more alike than different, and when I have any chance, I will embrace you because I want to be embraced as well. I have to know that about myself.
Bill T. Jones's new book is Story, Time, the Life of an Idea. It is published by Princeton University Press. What a great pleasure to have you on the program.
What a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Bill T. Jones's new book is Story, Time, The Life of an Idea. It is published by Princeton University Press. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. This edition of The Book Show was recorded at The Egg, Center for the Performing Arts in Albany, New York, theegg.org. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.